They were forced to go up on the roof of their cabin because of the rising water and ice.
Floodwaters overwhelm the community of Eagle. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 5th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new study on the cost of living in different communities across the state.
We're trying to measure the relative difference in cost of items in a market basket, ranging from housing to transportation to fuel to food and everything in between.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080.
Floodwater and chunks of ice from the Yukon River have caused major devastation in Eagle. The river has risen 40 feet above normal, well beyond the previous historic peak set in 1937. Local resident and National Weather Service observer John Borg says high water and heavy ice have swept through the lower part of the community.
Two buildings were destroyed. We can see the kindling out in the river when the ice stopped moving last night. Other buildings are laying in the wrong direction or pushed back and out of shape off the foundations. The store was floating last night for a while with water up to the ceiling. And everything where there was only water before is now packed in with chunks of ice.
Eagle is home to more than 100 people, and Borg estimates more than 30 have been displaced or had property lost or damaged. He says the old native village has been hardest hit.
The native village out here 3 miles above us was totally wiped out by the ice, and there were a few people, not all that many, but they lost everything.
Borg says the old village residents evacuated to the new village site on higher ground, but that the road and power lines from there to the city of Eagle have been severed. The State Department of Emergency Management, the National Park Service, and the Tanana Chiefs Conference are providing assistance for drinking water, food, and clothing. Most assistance is coming by air, as the only road into town, the graveled Taylor Highway, has been impacted by numerous washouts. Earlier today, a Park Service contracted helicopter rescued two residents and their sled dogs from a remote home site 12 miles downstream from Eagle. Yukon Charley National Preserve Superintendent Greg Dudgeson says Andy and Kate Basich were in a desperate situation.
They were asking for help. There was no way to reach high ground. Their cabin and property had taken one surge, that was their word, one surge from the river, and large chunks of the bank had been eroded away, and they didn't think they could survive a second surge.
Dudgeon says the National Park Service was notified and called in a helicopter to rescue the couple, who were doing everything they could to stay alive.
They were forced to go up on the roof of their cabin because of the rising water and ice. And according to the helicopter pilot, he thought the cabin and that site had probably less than an hour left before it was part of the river.
Dudgeon says the couple did everything they could to save their sled dogs, but not all of them made it.
My understanding about the dogs was that they were originally chained on the ground and near a couple of canoes that had been attached together to escape when the time came. And the ice and water rose so quickly that before the couple could react, the ice crushed the canoes and killed at least one dog, possibly another, and injured others.
Dudgeon says the Park Service is in contact with several other remote residents of the Yukon Charley region and is preparing to evacuate them if necessary. With so much heavy ice in the river and more meltwater flushing into the Yukon from an above-average snowpack upstream, more problems are anticipated at Eagle and downstream. State Department of Emergency Management spokesman Jeremy Zedig says river community residents need to take precautions.
So people should start preparing now, getting enough food and water to survive for 72 hours, put up in a safe location, having a battery-operated radio. They should stay out of floodwaters at all times. Talk with your community members about what you're going to do, where you're going to evacuate, and what supplies you have on hand.
160 miles downriver from Eagle at Circle, store owner Erla Hutchinson says residents began getting ready Monday.
They were packing up stuff and moving it to higher ground, which is good. You know, because some years you just never know. I mean, we got plenty of warning this year, so people were concerned and doing their stuff, and I got stuff up in the store, and so you just do what you do every year, not knowing what's going to happen.
Hutchinson says there's less chance of ice jamming at Circle because the Yukon is 2.5 miles wide there. Meanwhile, breakup on the Kuskokwim River is now threatening the downriver village of Gweethluk. Water has come over the bank at the lower section of the village, and the slough behind the village is also filling up. The situation there is safe for now, but residents are preparing for more serious flooding. People are moving their boats, snow machines, and dogs to higher ground. Further upriver, a rush of water flooded several villages over the weekend and on Monday. Homes in Red Devil were flooded, and roads in Aniak were washed out. Ben Balk is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service. He says those villages are now in the clear.
Now that the temperatures have cooled off, the water levels from the snowmelt are decreasing. And what we're seeing now is that there's not enough water yet in the system and the ice hasn't really broken down. You're seeing some shifting of ice sheets, but you're not seeing any dynamic ice run right now.
Ice is still covering much of the upper and lower sections of the Kuskokwim, but open holes are forming hourly. Bethel Search and Rescue is urging travelers to stay off the river. Life in Alaska is expensive. Most Alaskans agree with that. But until recently, no one knew exactly how expensive. A new report for the state's Department of Administration shows that the cost of living varies widely around the state. APRN's Dave Donaldson has more.
The new Geographic Cost Differentials Report is the first documented study done in 23 years detailing what people actually pay for the goods and services they buy in 18 different regions of the state. The study by Geno's McDowell Group shows that it costs 31% more to live in interior Alaska, off the road system, than it does to live in Anchorage. And while Fairbanks is 3% more expensive and Juneau is 11% more expensive, people who live in the Aleutians need a full 50% more money than those in the largest city. On the other hand, people in the Mat-Su need less, only 95% of the amount for living expenses as compared to Anchorage. The study was primarily commissioned to equalize the salaries of state employees who live in different parts of the state, and it will first be available for use in negotiating new labor contracts for 6 unions representing those employees. Deputy Commissioner of Administration Kevin Brooks says updating the information reflects a recognition that costs are changing, and it was time to measure the costs of such things as housing and transportation and food.
A study like this is intended to measure the relative difference in cost compared to Anchorage. Anchorage is the base, and so we're trying to measure the relative difference in cost of items in a market basket ranging from housing to transportation to fuel to food and everything in between. And so we're not looking to assign us an absolute value. Will it cost $4.50 for a gallon of milk, but it really is trying to measure that difference.
The labor negotiations begin this fall, opening with the general government unit, representing the largest group of state employees. Jim Duncan is business manager for the Alaska State Employees Association. He's looked at the results of the study and compared them to the union's existing contract. He says it'll be a major item on the table because the new study shows some changes in cost of living.
There's major differences, just pointing out some of them. For example, in our contract right now, Juneau is at, it doesn't have a geographic differential. Under the study that came out, they'd have 11% increase. Fairbanks right now is 4% above, and under the study, they'd be at 3%, so there'd be a slight drop. Ketchikan is at 0 in our contract, and they'd be at 4% in under the new study. So there are a number of differences, a number of overall differences. So clearly, this is important to our members, especially in those areas where the studies recognize that there's an increased cost of living.
Duncan says that the differential will not be the final factor, though. He says 45% of his members work in Anchorage and would not be affected by the report. They will be watching the new base salary figures. Non-union state employees will also be covered, but by legislation, with the cost of living adjustments included as a part of their package, but only after going through the legislative process. The McDowell Report is just a document. It's not been adopted by anyone so far. And Brooks says it will not necessarily be the final factor anywhere.
Any implementation at all is contingent upon negotiations with each of those bargaining units and funding by the legislature of the monetary terms of those bargaining agreements. And then in the case of our non-covered employees, that requires a bill. You know, we'll have to change the statute if we are going to implement the findings of this study. So this is a starting point, really.
The state uses geographic differentials in various ways, all of which would require changes in law or in regulation. The costs are used in some grants that cover programs in different regions, in settling claims, retirement benefits, and aid programs that are also income-related. Their first test, however, will be those labor contracts. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the recession leaves a floating ministry high and dry in Ketchikan.
There's been sort of a groundswell response, and there's sort of a kind of a no, this isn't going to happen kind of an attitude.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America.
The U.S. Supreme Court is requesting supplemental briefs on the Kensington Mine case. The High Court yesterday asked attorneys for mine owner Core Alaska and conservation groups to answer two additional questions on the tailings discharge into Lower Slate Lake. The state of Alaska joined with Core in the case. The Supreme Court is deciding whether the Kensington's plan to store mine waste in the freshwater lake is legal under the Clean Water Act. The case was argued in January on appeal from the Ninth Circuit Court, which has ruled the mine's tailing permit is illegal. The court is asking both sides what they believe the correct judicial remedy would be in the future Clean Water Act cases if Kensington's tailings discharge is determined to violate the act. The second question regards the permitting process if the discharge satisfies the definition of fill material under the act. The briefs must be filed by May 15th. Responses are due by the 22nd. Core spokesman Tony Ebersol says the company would respond to the briefs by the deadline. He had no other comments. Earth Justice Attorney Tom Waldo argued the case before the Supreme Court for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council and other environmental groups. He says he's encouraged the court is seeking new information.
The questions that the court asks suggest that they do not accept a simplistic approach and are probing what effect the effluent limitations from EPA have on the judicial remedy in the case and on what the right permitting process is.
Waldo says the fact the court is probing the question so carefully shows the case is important nationwide.
It's not just a case about one small lake in Alaska. It's a case about lakes and rivers and streams all over the country. We're glad that the Supreme Court is taking such a hard look at these questions.
Waldo says the court's decision probably won't come until June. The Kensington Gold Mine is about 45 miles north of Juneau. A legal tailings facility is the last major hurdle to mine operations. Some cruise industry officials say a head tax on passengers is scaring ships away from Alaska. Authors of the fee say that's not the reason ships are heading elsewhere. And an independent analyst says the truth is somewhere in the middle. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Few people are disputing this fact. Cruise lines are yanking ships out of the Alaska market next year.
People that have made announcements for pulling a ship out are Royal Caribbean, NCL, Princess, and Holland America reduced one of their ships, the amount of visitors, in half.
Alaska Travel Industry Association President Ron Peck says as many as 140,000 berths will be lost during next summer's season. That's close to a 15% drop from the 1 million or so people expected this year. But the reason is in dispute.
There's no doubt the economy is part of it, but you cannot deny the fact that this, what I call the onerous ballot initiative that had, you know, six different elements to it, have added added to the operation costs of the cruise industry in Alaska.
Industry leaders cite the $50 per person passenger fee as the chief reason ships are going elsewhere. They're also unhappy about a corporate income tax, a gambling tax, and new regulations. But that's not the only view.
Attributing downturns in cruise passengers to fees that they're being charged in Alaska, I think is inappropriate on the part of the cruise ship guys. They know better.
Chip Toma of Responsible Cruising in Alaska says most of the fees are being borne by passengers, not cruise lines. And tourists spend enough that it just doesn't make a difference.
Between their airfare, their hotel, their rental car, their ship, all their fees, and all their food, and all their purchases in Alaska, and all the trips they're going to go on, it's well over $3,000. So $50, for instance, on a passenger head tax is very, very little.
Alaska saw fourfold increases in cruise ship capacity over the past two decades. It's been flat for several years, and though it's going to start dropping, it's still a major part of the business.
You know, when you look at it, the big picture is there's still a lot of ships in Alaska, despite all the talk.
Industry veteran Mike Driscoll says Alaska's loss is part of a worldwide shift. The number of Americans booking cruises has leveled out, and there's growth overseas, which stays overseas.
I think Alaska, unlike some of the other markets, though, for some reason does not have a strong pull for Europeans taking cruises there. There's a higher percentage taking cruises in the Caribbean, and there's a higher percentage, obviously, taking cruises in Europe. And so those markets are beginning to grow. And it's not like Alaska is less appealing to its basic traveler. Just the North American cruise traveler is not growing as it did in the 90s.
In fact, two of the ships leaving state waters next year are headed for the Caribbean. Driscoll of the publication Cruise Week says lines are already lowering fares by about a third to fill up their ships. That's made profit margins tighter and increased the impact of new taxes and fees.
Their costs of doing business in Alaska are greater than their costs of doing business in the Caribbean or Europe. And I personally don't think it keeps people away from Alaska because the ships are going to sail full. So they're going to find a price point that fills those ships. But in a certain sense, I believe it hurts Alaska because, you know, the cruise lines are less profitable there than they used to be. And so they'll, you know, they'll look elsewhere.
The cruise industry's impacts go beyond port cities in southeast Alaska. A recent study shows 40% of visitors start or end their trips in Whittier or Seward. Many also travel throughout the south central and interior regions of the state. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
Trident Seafoods will pay more than $112,000 for not reporting large quantities of hazardous chemicals to the EPA. The company violated the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act by not telling local emergency response teams that they had large quantities of ammonia, a hazardous chemical, at processing plants in Accutane, Kodiak, Petersburg, and Seattle. EPA Public Affairs Specialist Tony Brown says the chemicals endangered the surrounding communities.
And it's important because if there is a mishap or something happens, you want to make sure that the response teams, in this case, your fire departments and other ones, are aware that, oh, okay, this company has, you know, over 10,000 or whatever amounts of ammonia at their facility. And if they have to respond to a fire or a leak or something that could happen, then the response teams know what they're dealing with.
Exposure to large quantities of ammonia can cause respiratory problems and eye irritations, and it is highly explosive. Trident will pay a $61,000 penalty to the federal government and will fund a supplemental environmental project. The company did not respond to requests for comment.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communications System, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world. And by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
A species of albatross that at one time was thought to be extinct is slowly making a comeback with a little help. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Historically, the short-tailed albatross was the most abundant species of albatross in the North Pacific. However, the population crashed, and in 1949, the species was thought to be extinct. That turned out to be premature thinking because the short-tailed albatross has slowly recovered. The species is apparently growing by 7% a year with a current population estimate of 2.5 thousand birds. The short-tailed albatross breeds exclusively in islands of Japan, but they spend a great deal of time foraging in waters off Alaska. While the species is slowly recovering, only two of the 14 historical breeding islands are currently occupied. Additionally, an estimated 85% of the population nest on an unstable slope on a volcanic island that has erupted three times over the past 100 years. The other breeding colony is in the Shinkaku Islands just north of Taiwan. Three different nations claim those islands, and there have been no visits by research biologists in the past 5 years. With those factors in mind, a project was started last year to set up another short-tailed albatross breeding colony on a stable, historic site that, if successful, could be a step towards taking the species off the endangered species list. It's part of established Japanese territory and is volcanically inactive. The method used to try and establish the new colony was to take 10 albatross chicks from an existing colony in February of last year and move them to the new island. One of the principals in the project was Robert Surian with Oregon State University. During a recent science symposium, he confirmed that the chicks were hand-reared and released with the hope that they will return to start the new colony.
These birds are being removed from the colony at one month old. So they've at least had, you know, during the egg stage, they're hearing vocalizations from the adults, albatrosses. They talk to their eggs. And also they've seen the stimuli for the first month of hearing short-tailed albatross vocalizations, seeing pairs involved in courtship. And so just we did see these young chicks prior to fledging exhibiting courtship displays too, just like you'd see on a colony. So hopefully that's enough. We'll find out.
The observations from the project confirmed that the hand-reared birds were heavier, had longer wings, and fledged earlier than chicks studied in the wild. The study featured satellite transmitters to monitor five of the chicks once they were released, and Surian noted that only one of the birds ultimately died.
The four birds that did survive and migrate from each group, they're in red Torishima and yellow Mukojima, they in overall showed roughly similar migration patterns, but there were some subtle differences that we will investigate with more larger sample sizes in future years.
Another interesting observation was the differences in the habitat used by the hand-reared birds and the control group of birds that were observed in the wild.
The Mukojima birds spent more time over the shelf regions and compared to Torishima birds, and then they also spent less time in oceanic regions compared to the Torishima birds. But the interesting comparison here is that the this distribution is very different than adults, which spend much more time over the shelf break and slope regions compared to the shelf and oceanic. The young birds spend far more time in the western Bering Sea and up onto the Bering Sea shelf, and then also in the eastern North Pacific.
The effort to establish the new short-tailed albatross breeding colony on Mukojima Island is scheduled to continue for the next 5 years, or until 100 chicks are relocated. A determination on the success of the project could be years away, because the released birds won't begin returning to the colony for at least 3 to 4 years, and they won't start breeding until 6 to 8 years. The short-tailed albatross relocation project was international in flavor, with researchers from the Yamashina Institute for Ornithology, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and Oregon State University. If the project turns out to be successful, it would be the first time in history that humans have helped establish a new albatross colony. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
A floating southeast ministry has hit some rough waters. Since 1988, the motor vessel Christian has traveled to southeast Alaska's most isolated communities, providing pastoral care, vacation Bible camps, and sacraments. But as KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports, the global recession has put the future of the MV Christian in doubt.
For nearly 18 years, Pastor Stan Berenson's home was the pulpit of Ketchikan's First Lutheran Church. Berenson's pastoral life took a distinctly unique turn last spring when he took on the job as the pastor and skipper of the MV Christian. Since last year, Berenson and his wife Sharon Geldecker have been sailing the vessel through southeast Alaska, visiting with residents in the far reaches of the region.
It was interesting. Sharon oftentimes would say, she's sort of interested in trying to do church differently. And I said, well, this is about as different as it can get, because you're For one thing, you don't have a congregation. You have a number of people that you relate to and you try and encourage.
The couple says the duties of a traveling ministry can be as varied as the communities they visit.
If people invite you in their homes, you go. You know, if somebody says, how about some tea, you go. You know, because you're always just seeking where the hospitality is, you know. We do worship services if there is a group that's used to doing that. As a Lutheran, we're word and sacrament people, so I'll do communion, you know, if they
baptisms,
want.
Baptisms, you know, weddings.
Baptism if they want. There's been weddings on the boat.
Yeah.
Geldecker is also a trained nurse and is hoping to begin offering basic medical care during those visits. The 65-foot, 75-ton MV Christian was first launched in 1971. Originally, it was used as a Lutheran outdoor ministry for youth in Puget Sound. The vessel was brought to the state in 1988, where it began primarily serving Southeast Alaska's logging camps. With a rapidly dwindling number of logging camps in the region, Geldecker says the vessel now primarily visits native villages and some of the region's most isolated areas.
It's gone to places where if there's not even a community, it's just a float house, you know, such like that. So it's basically we go where we're invited and see where the spirit leads us. It's kind of a new way to experience Alaska and to be of service and to give back to these communities. Ketchikan has been awfully good to both Dan and I in so many different ways, and we just appreciate living in Alaska and maybe going a little deeper into the more remote areas. It's been very fun, except that we didn't get to do it very long before the recession hit.
With an average of $180,000 in annual operating costs and major gifts drying up, Berenson says he received word in January that the boat was being taken out of service.
It's sitting in Wrangell in the shipyard, up on blocks and stands, high and dry.
As word of the fate of the MV Christian traveled throughout the region, Berenson says support began mounting for its continued operation.
There's been sort of a groundswell response once people found out that it was, oh, a lot of people know this boat. And there was sort of a kind of a, no, no, this isn't going to happen kind of an attitude.
With some lobbying, the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America and Lutheran Association agreed to keep Berenson and Geldecker on to help raise funds for the MV Christian. Originally, the Lutheran Association had committed to relaunching the vessel if $150,000 could be raised over the course of the next several months. Geldecker says she plans on writing grants to help supplement the approximately $20,000 that has already been raised. Even with new fundraisers planned around the region, they expect they'll raise somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000. The couple says it appears the boat may be refloated prior to all of the money being raised. In the anticipation, they'll be able to come up with the rest.
It's a bit of a faith journey.
In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Brass in Fairbanks, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Rosemarie Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
And by
the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.